I think there's a lot of people who think that being a young Earth creationist is like the most pious option. You end up having to malign an awful lot of fellow believers when you think something like that, rather than saying, you know, again, it's a 3,000-year-old book. Maybe we've missed something.
You're listening
to the Thinking Matters podcast.
Conversations
at the intersection of faith,
culture,
and reason.
I'm your host, Todd Funk, and today I'm honored to be joined by Dr. Luke Barnes. Luke, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, good to have you. Luke is an astrophysicist and a senior lecturer in physics at Western Sydney University. And Luke, according to Google, you tend to focus your research on galaxy formation and kind of the fine-tuning of the universe. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's about right. So broadly sort of cosmology, the really big stuff. And I'm on the theoretical side of things. How to, you know, what will the laws of nature have to say, simulations, all that sort of stuff.
Okay, cool. And before we jump right into the heavy duty intellectual things, let me just ask you a little about you. Are you married? Do you have kids?
I am married. I've actually in December, I'll be married for 20 years.
I've got congratulations. Two kids. Uh-huh. How old are they?
Two kids, 15 and 12. So... yep, getting spicy. It's the fun bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I live in sort of southwest Sydney and yeah.
All right. And outside of kind of physics and theology and stuff, what brings joy and refreshment to Luke Barnes, you know, your everyday life? Do you have outlets and hobbies or things that kind of keep you from burning out or getting stale?
Yeah, in the last, I guess, 8 or 9 years, I've been playing the cello is one of my outlets. So... having sort of played a few instruments a bit all right, I sort of started taking lessons in the cello, you know, nearly 9 years ago now. So yeah, that's yeah. My
thing. Were you musical growing up, or why the cello?
Yeah, so I had piano lessons from, yeah, it's a bit of a story. I had piano lessons growing up from the, you know, from a young age. So thanks to my parents for that. Always enjoyed it. And then out of high school, when I started uni, for reasons I don't even remember, I don't even think I had a reason, I took out the bass guitar and sort of happened to join a band for when I was in uni. So that was great fun. Uh-huh. And then got back into the piano a bit. And then my wife just happened to see a cello very cheap on like Facebook Marketplace or something and bought it for me. And immediately regretted the obsession she started. So yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I've recently gained an appreciation. There's a series of these concerts called Candlelight throughout New Zealand. And there was a string quartet and yeah. With the cello. And man, we did it at the old, I don't know if you're familiar with Auckland, but I think it was St. Peter's up at, you know, the top of Auckland area. And man, it just resonated. It was beautiful.
Yeah,
man,
yeah.
When done well. Yeah. Are you from Australia or Sydney, or where are you from?
I'm from Australia. If you look on the map, the Sydney and the next major city to the north is Brisbane. About halfway okay. In between is okay. A town called Maxville. That's where I'm from.
Yeah, very good. And what Luke, what first kind of sparked your interest or your curiosity in physics and the universe? I mean, was there a defining moment or a particular teacher or an event?
Not particularly. It's sort of stages of things. I was good at maths growing up. And when you're good at something, you sort of, you know, enjoy doing it more than the people who are sort of struggle with it. So then year 11 and 12, we did physics, and sort of seeing equations actually describe the real world was a bit of a revelation for me. I didn't immediately do that at university, but eventually decided that physics was my thing. So I did a physics degree and, yeah, I just learned then that astrophysics and especially cosmology was just the most interesting, you know, seeing equations apply to the real world was wonderful. Seeing them apply to the whole universe was something else entirely. So
yeah,
that's what drew me in.
And let me ask probably a dumb question. You're an astrophysicist. Do you get to glance out of the telescope, actually, to get observations and stuff? I mean, Jupiter aligns or whatever. Do you go out and take a peek?
That's not a dumb question. That's a great question. I keep saying I'm a theorist, so no one lets me anywhere near the telescopes. And that's kind of, professionally, that's true. I mean, in the sort of the cutting edge world, all the really great telescopes in the world are like on a mountain in Chile or... you know, on top of a volcano, extinct, we hope, a volcano in Hawaii. So,
yeah,
so no one, I mean, only the real experts, the real technical experts go to those anyway, but they're sort of the observers and I'm on the theorist side. On a, right. on a, amateur level, I'm very impressed by the fact that, we have in Sydney, there must be in around a place, amateur astronomy societies of just not professionals, but they just mostly like retired people who just like, oh, I've really wanted that telescope my whole life and now I'm going to get it. Yeah. And I have a telescope. I'll occasionally set it up, but I'm often at events with these groups and they have some amazing kit. Equipment, and they know it really well. So that's my sort of most, if I'm looking through a piece of a telescope, it's usually someone else's.
Yeah. When I was back in California teaching, I taught science for 10 years and they said, we need some electives. What? And I said, well, I know nothing about astronomy and oceanography. Let me teach a double, you know, once half the year of this. And so with both classes, I was just like a day ahead of the students in my knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just got such a knee jerk, especially with astronomy. You know, I'd go by Mr. Todd. My name is Todd Funk. Mr. Todd. And I knew I'd say, I don't know at the end of their question, because there was just so much of astronomy I didn't know. I'd have to go home and Google it and whatnot, but it was big fun. And we had the classes go out with a little, you know, 6-inch reflector. And it was just great, man. I love looking at the heavens. So at what point did you realize, maybe there wasn't a definitive point, but did you realize that God could use your love for science and your rationality and intellect as a tool for, say, apologetics and evangelism even? Because I grew up with a charismatic church and I didn't even know God could use my brain until about 10, 15 years ago.
Well, it's strange. I grew up in a church that was young earth creationist, actually.
Okay.
And so that, in a way, drew me into science because if you're going to take that line, there's a lot you've got to sort of fight in science if you want to hold the line there.
Yeah.
As part of my... you know, I don't believe that's the best way to read the science or Genesis anymore. But along the way, sort of, you know, discovered various areas, including fine tuning, where there was just something very interesting was going on, and you know, Christians weren't quite up to date with it. So being able to sort of do that, I almost fell into it backwards. You know, just. You know, I was just trying to be an astronomer, and then you know, this stuff about fine tuning caught my interest, and suddenly I'm being asked to speak about it.
Did you find any moments of faith crisis? Because if you grew up in a young Earth creationist setting, you begin to question these things and question Genesis and what else is kind of, you know, metaphorically speaking or whatever.
Funnily enough, not really, because I'd sort of been aware of the fact that there's. You know, the most that follows from that is, okay, you know, here's a 3,000-year-old book, Genesis, and I didn't fully understand a bit of it. And that's not the most, you know, devastating realization.
Yeah.
You know, I still don't know what Revelation's going on about. So, that, you know, it's just not that surprising. You know, I knew there were options. So there was no sort of particular crisis of faith, and it happened fairly gradually, as these things tend to do. You just sort of, one of the things that really got to me was I sort of assembled all this sort of young Earth creationist stuff on astronomy. And as my sort of education continued, I was able to look at that and not just take their word for it, but sort of check up on whether they were doing it right. And very often they were just making mistakes, just, you know, it was just bad critiques and bad understandings. And it's funny, the standard young earth creationist line is you take the word of man over the word of God. And what eventually drew me away from young earth creationism was I have stopped trusting the word of these young earth creationists when they said science says this and science says that, because they're misrepresenting it in various ways.
Yeah, fair. I grew up in a young earth creationist mindset as well. And it was about a dozen or so years ago that I began to really examine it a little more deeply. And all the apologists and people that I really respected, come to find out most of them were, you know, your old earth creationist type people. Yeah. Do you think that's kind of one of the biggest kind of misconceptions Christians have about science in general or cosmology specifically, is just the age of the earth and the cosmos?
I think there's a lot of people who think that being a young earth creationist is like the most pious option. Like if you have a high view of scripture, you have to be a young earth creationist.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's particularly helpful. I don't think it's true for a start. You end up having to malign an awful lot of fellow believers when you think something like that, rather than saying, you know, again, it's a 3,000-year old book, maybe not written to you in a completely different culture. You know, maybe we've missed something. It's funny, I've been reading recently, I just finished it on an audio book. Gavin Ortland has a very good book on outlining Augustine's view of Genesis and of creation in general. So Augustine, 400 AD, and just saying, look, I mean, all the things that your present day Genesis isn't quite as literal as you think it is, person is saying, is Augustine said 1600 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, I was fed that line too, that, you know, the early church fathers onward all believed in the literal 6-day creation account. And it's just not true. There were people questioning that early in the piece. And it's a shame that the young earth creation camp, they do tend to be very dogmatic and question the sincerity or even Christianity of people who believe otherwise.
Although, funnily enough, that's not what it was like for me growing up. So the local high school teacher would, you know, debate with the pastor, who happened to be dad, about evolution. And he wasn't, you know, they were the only time I ever saw them really, you know, disagree about something was, the other guy had beaten dad at squash. And so, you know, that was pretty tragic. That was all funny. But that was, you know, it was weirdly non-dogmatic, which is, I just don't see. There's a church where, okay, from the pulpit is coming young earth creationism, but there's an evolutionary biologist, a high school teacher just sitting in the pews, you know, and they're in the same church, and that's fine because it's a small country town. You can't be that picky.
Right.
But I see, yeah, just in the US, in other parts of Australia, less in the UK maybe, but just this, you know, it's part of the creed, and that's a bad idea.
Yeah, for sure. You know, in your Cosmic Revolutionaries Handbook, you kind of defend the Big Bang, getting into your books here. Why? I was a bit surprised to know that it was really under attack. I know the young earth creationists attack it, but who else might attack it? And why? Are there too many unanswered questions or inconsistencies about the theory?
There's all sorts of people who go after it. There are people who think this, when the Big Bang arrived on the scene, it looked too much like, you know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There was a real backlash against it because it looked too theological. So there are all sorts of really interesting quotes that sort of die off as the evidence for the Big Bang theory really ramps up and becomes pretty solid in the 60s. The people saying, well, this is just theology, suddenly just sort of, let's not say that anymore. But there's still this leftover of people who think that it's just all, you know, this is true of all modern science. There's always someone who thinks it's all bunk. And actually the idea for the book came from my collaborator, Geraint Lewis, who I've written both of my books with. And the thing that triggered it was when you're an astronomer, you get, you know, it's part of becoming an astronomer. And it's funny when our PhD students start to get these emails from just random members of the public who just start saying, I know how to do all this astronomy stuff right. You guys are doing it all wrong. Let me tell you about all this. Here's
tainted by too many years of education and study.
Yeah, here's my 200-page Word document all in caps. And so it was really like, look, I can predict what's going to happen here. It's all high school-level maths. You don't actually understand the evidence for the theory to then try to fix its problem, so to speak. So why don't we just write a guide? So here's how to properly overthrow the Big Bang, if that's what you want to do.
Right. Okay. What are some of the biggest pushbacks about it? I mean, problems or unanswered questions. Is it dark matter? I mean, what would it be?
So the standard thing would be things like, in the standard model, there's dark matter and dark energy. And if you say, well, that's a bit of a fudge, actually, we kind of agree with you. It's just the best fudge we've got right now.
Right.
On a more deep level, people will say things like, you know, expanding space itself doesn't make any sense. The curvature of space itself doesn't make any sense. It doesn't account for various observations. And sometimes, like, so one of the last chapter of the book is, all right, here's the real open questions, right? Here's the stuff, you know, there is stuff it can't explain because we haven't fully worked out the universe. It's sort of the best we've got, and it's doing rather right. well on a whole bunch of things, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's had some great predictions, hasn't it? I mean, you know, with cosmic background radiation and whatnot. Good stuff. And what about, you know, in the fortunate universe, you explore kind of the fine tuning. What is there an aspect of the fine tuning that strikes you as a strongest kind of argument towards a designer, or is it a cumulative case?
I think it's a cumulative case. I think there are sort of stronger cases and less strong cases. But I think what's interesting to me at the moment is just seeing the way that people who realized it first, the physicists who said, well, what if we've got these numbers and they describe something about our universe, what if they've been a bit different? And then they sort of sit down and do the maths and do the physics and do the equations, and then they
When was that? Was it, what decades were that the light bulbs began to turn on?
It's sort of mixed up in another, in questions about these constants that before you sort of realize that life has anything to do with it. So famously sort of Paul Dirac, famous physicist, is thinking that the values of these constants have some weird coincidences with each other, just numerically, nothing to do with life. If you put these constants together, this number 10 to the power of 40 turns up, which is an enormous number. But if you put these constants together, 10 to the 40 turns up as well. Like, so what's going on there? It's weird that such a huge number turns up independently. And in the 60s, Robert Dickey says, I think I know why. This one... Right, one of these huge numbers is in certain units that roughly the age of a star, and the other one in again the same unit is roughly the age of the universe. You know, factor of 10 either way or whatever. And so he says, "Oh, I see. You got to see what's happening here. We can't have existed before, you know, the first stars have made the material that we're made out of." So you would expect, you know, you would expect these numbers to be similar to each other, or to observers to see that, you know, a generation of stars go past and then here comes the observers. So they would see a universe which is at least as old as the stars around them. And so these numbers, it's not that weird that these numbers are similar. But then you've opened the door. This is what Dickey said. You know, now the question of why is this fundamental feature of the universe like this, and the answer was not because that's what the laws of nature are. The answer is because we are the kind of thing that turns up in the universe after stars have made the material for planets, and then planets have somehow made us, right? If you're that kind of thing, you can only turn up in certain places and certain times in the universe, and that might explain a lot of what we see in the universe around us. Once you've opened that door, you then naturally ask the question, well, what other features of our universe might be sort of strongly dependent on or strongly influence our existence, right? And not because we're special or anything like that, or because, you know, you're human beings in particular, but just, you know, if you're wondering why you observe this or that or the other, the question of under what conditions will the universe observe this or that or the other, you know, where will the observers be? When will they be? What will they look like? Is a question you've now got to answer. So that's how it sort of, we then came around to, hang on, this constant, if you change it very slightly, suddenly everyone's dead, right? No one's observing anything.
Yeah. I heard Roland Locke, our CEO of Thinking Matter, said that you helped with William Lane Craig's animated videos about, you know, is that accurate?
Well, help is one way of putting it.
Critiqued, hindered, I don't know.
No, well, this nice little short explainer video, and I was looking at it and I thought, hang on, there were some numbers of these constants, right, that just sort of scrolled past, and no one cares, right, is my understanding. These are just like, but I was looking at it and I was like, oh, hang on, two of those are wrong. And I just sort of sent an email. I went, this doesn't really matter, but these two numbers are wrong.
Yeah.
Whoever was doing it, because he didn't do the animation, of course, sent an email back saying, yeah, we got those from your paper. Why is she? And so I looked at my paper and I'm like, ah, there's typos. Ah, that's a bit tragic. There was a number wrong and a particular unit that was wrong. And so I just had to say, oh, sorry. Anyway, that was funny.
Yeah. I mean, when the layperson watches a video like that, it's, I don't know, four minutes or whatever. And you think, how could anyone not come to a conclusion of a designer? I mean, you co-authored your paper with Geraint.
Geraint, if you really want to roll the R and be Welsh about it. So,
but Geraint and, you know, your Neil deGrasse Tysons, they are obviously, you know, agnostic at best. Does it puzzle you? You scratch your head and say, how do you not get there?
I think the problem is, one of the problems is, it looks like invoking God is always making the problem worse. If your picture of God is of some complex thing that just sort of hangs around outside of the universe. I mean, this is sort of Dawkins' argument. Like, however complex the universe is, whatever made the universe must be more complex, so it would be more in need of a designer, and so you've just made things worse. We have to explain in the direction of simplicity, not in the direction of complexity. The answer to that, of course, is we don't think of God as complex. God isn't made out of God's parts. So, but if you just have that intuitive picture of like a guy with a beard on a cloud who starts just sort of making atoms and sending thunderstorms and being cranky about people misbehaving, then, you know, no amount of evidence, like, there's a very strong sense, this is one of the reasons why I love fine-tuning, is that there's a very strong sense from anyone who hears about it that, ah, you know, something is going on here. I think this quote I heard from Alistair McGrath, but it was, he gave a talk about fine-tuning and someone said, I'm not religious, but something weird is going on here. That was his fine-tuning. And I think that's right. Actually, I was in New Zealand, this is a couple of years ago now, and there was a skeptics at the pub meeting that I'd been invited to speak at. I think Zach Arden had worked that out for me. So thanks, Zach. And I presented fine-tuning the science. And then at some point I was able to say, look, I've written a book about this with Geraint Lewis, Fortunate Universe. He's an atheist. We agree on all this science. We might be wrong, but we agree on all this science. And now here's the sort of case for God. And what was amazing was the room obviously started sort of arguing with me because that's what they're there for, skeptics in the pub. That's what they, that's the fun they love. But what was fascinating was when they started arguing with each other, they started, like, someone would raise an objection and someone else would answer that objection. No, that doesn't work for this reason. And no, this doesn't. And then at a while, I was just sort of standing back, just watching the room argue with itself, having a wonderful time. So the feeling that it's got to be something, that's quite strong. But if you think that a move towards God is always a move, is always a backwards, you know, bad strategy.
Yeah.
Rationally, then you just have to try and move somewhere else, like the multiverse or whatever.
Yeah. Well, do you find, I mean, we're accused of imposing the God of the gaps in, you know, we don't know, it must be God. Do you think that, like, a multiverse or just sheer chance or physical necessity, like there must be some laws that are going to explain it one day? Do you think that's the science of the gaps, as it's been called?
I don't think, well, I really want to stress a difference between the fine-tuning argument and some other arguments. It's no premise of the fine-tuning argument. It's not there at all to say, here's something we observe about nature and science doesn't know how to explain it. Right? It's no. Let's assume we've got it all working beautifully, right? Let's take the best laws we've got. Let's assume they explain all the stuff we see around us. What if those laws had been different? So it's what philosophers call a counterfactual. So it's not, you know, what caused this? It can't be the natural things. No, we're not doing that. What if, let's go to the basis, like the bottom of physics, and say, this is doing great. You know, our universe doing fine. What if it had been a bit different? And the reason that's important is because it's not a gap in the sense that the future progress of science will necessarily fill it in. So it could be that we progress scientifically, we go from laws as we know them to a deeper set of laws, and they explain the universe a bit better than what we've got. But then we look at those and say, what if those had been a bit different and fine tuning is still there? Or worse, you know, it could be even finer fine tuning. So I'm not saying that there's any problem with the laws of physics as we have them. I think they're probably incomplete for various other reasons. But all I'm saying, you know, it's this higher metaphysical question of what if things had been not like this, but like something else. The reason that's important is because if you say something like the origin of life can't be explained by the laws of nature that we know. Now, that could be true. And you could make that case. The laws of nature aren't magic. They can't just do anything. So it's entirely possible you could scientifically come to the conclusion, look, you know, you're not going to make a replicating cell given life. Now, that's a hard conclusion to come to, but it's possible. The future progress of science then could completely just erase that argument entirely if someone could show how a bunch of chemicals turn into life. With fine tuning, it's the future progress of science doesn't necessarily, you know, it could make it better, it could make it worse, because we're asking a question that's not about the adequacy of causal, of scientific natural processes to do anything. We're asking why it's this way rather than some other way.
Yeah. Well, and the multiverse, for the people that don't understand it, it's just the postulate there's an infinite number of universes, therefore we're the lucky one that got all the dial settings correct. How is it, Luke, or what's been postulated as to a source of generation of not just an infinite number of universes, but an infinite number of one that each have different constants, different laws, different settings of the dials, as it's been compared to?
The thing you've got to realize at this point is the physics we currently know about, as in the sort of best physical theories we have today, don't generate a multiverse. But, you know, it's most physicists would say it's highly likely, including myself, that, you know, we're not done with physics yet. Thank goodness. I've still got a job, right? That there's some deeper physics to be known. So when you're in the mode of, all right, what might this deeper physics be? This is sort of the creative mode of physics that most people don't think about or understand. That at some point, all of the great physical theories, someone just went, like they're not written out there on a card in nature somewhere and we find them. Someone went, oh, what if the universe was like this? And they said this equation, maybe that's what it's like. Or this equation, maybe that's what, at some point you just write it down and go, well, there's an idea. I wonder if I'm right. There's a creative step before you actually go and check. So at that level, it's a bit like you're just writing a novel in equations, right? You could tell the story of this hypothetical universe in equations. You can write them down and the space-time will do this and the matter will do that. And this constant is really this dynamical thing and it varies this way. And the universe starts off like this and, you know, inflates and bubbles, you know, like you can just tell all of that story. And because it's written in equations, it's precise enough that we could hopefully want to test it. But it's still fiction, right? Until we actually go and check whether it's true or not. Now, the next question is, like, that's all right. You know, none of that is bad, right? As a physicist, this is what you do, right? The challenge is to try to guess, right? Try to write the fiction that turns out to be nonfiction, if you want to put it that way. So this is all fine, but it's just, you've got to remember what the status of these ideas is. It's just, for the moment, an idea that we haven't really tested. There's various ways we could try and test it, even though we can't, in almost all these models, we can't see the other universes. But the thing you really want to do, remember, the question is not, does this, you know, this physical law, whether it's laws as we know them or a multiverse law, does this set of scientific, you know, laws of nature, would they explain the universe we see? The question is, okay, these laws, what if they'd been a bit different? And if I don't even know what those laws are, it's very hard for me to ask that question. The multiverse is not really answering the problem as it's sort of pushing the problem too far away for me to hope to get an answer. Like, I want to get in behind the scenes, but we get in behind the scenes of the laws as we know them, where there's these dials, then we start changing the dials and having a whole bunch of fun. I can't do that with the multiverse. I don't know what the dials are. No one does.
Right, right. Do you think it's an honest intellectual attempt, or do you think it's kind of a punt? Just kind of, you know, the multiverse?
As cosmology, it's an idea that is perfectly, you know, as a creative idea of a, here's an idea we can explore, it's fine. It's a, don't want to say it's not science. It's, It's not all of science, but this sort of creative, well, what if the universe was like this? What would that explain? That's part of science. So I don't want to say it's that, but as an answer to the fine-tuning argument, it's not so much, hey, what if there was a multiverse? It's the assumption that any multiverse would automatically solve all the problems of fine-tuning. And that, I think, is the real mistake, because we don't know ahead of time whether the multiverse itself needs to be fine-tuned, right? Maybe if you get the settings wrong, your multiverse generator just produces dud after dud after dud after dud. So Robin Collins likes to use the example of a bread maker, right? You know those things? You put the oil in and then they do all the stuff. If your bread maker is faulty, it just makes bad loaf after bad loaf after bad loaf.
Right.
They're all bad. So that's entirely possible. The real hard one is if you get the for most of the settings of the multiverse dials, whatever they are, the life that turns up in the universe, the bits of the universe that are complex enough to do something like a brain, aren't like us, where we live on a nice planet around a star. We have a sort of long history. Before us, we live on an Earth that has a sort of coherent, you know, shaped by natural forces. Maybe we're just like a cosmic fluke and we just sort of turned up in the middle of chaos for about 20 seconds, had some thoughts, and then dissolved back into chaos. These are called Boltzmann brains.
Boltzmann's brains. Yeah. I've heard of them. So it's just, am I that brain or are you? Which one of us is the real deal?
Well,
that's what I always thought about.
There's two separate problems here. And I think one of them is, what if one of them sort of the philosophical problem, which is, what if it's a bit similar to what if I was a brain in a vat, right? This famous philosophical thing of like, you're in the matrix, you're plugged in somewhere. That's the Boltzmann me. What if I, without knowing it, I'm really a Boltzmann brain? Now we can put that problem as that's the sort of philosophical problem. The scientific version of this problem is if I have, again, this is the creative bit of it. I've made my universe on paper and pencil or in a computer or whatever. I've got my idea of how I think the universe might work. And then I say, all right, within that universe, something turns up which is complex enough to observe what's around it. What do they see? And if you're going to explain our universe, it should be not ridiculously unlikely that they look like an embodied, entity on a planet around a star. That can't be ridiculously unlikely. It's a real problem if your universe says, if your, model universe says, actually, with overwhelming probability, they sort of wake up, look around, see absolute chaos around them for 10 seconds and then dissolve back into nothing. That's a problem. It's just a failed prediction at that point. It's just scientifically wrong.
Right, right. In talking to you a little bit, it seems like you've picked up a minor in philosophy along the way. You've had to discuss these kinds of things, huh?
I've joked that no one's ever made me read Hegel, so I'm not a real philosopher.
Okay.
That's my standard joke. And again, because I've never read Hegel, I don't know why that's funny, but every room of philosophers finds that funny. I gather he's impenetrable, but
I haven't read philosophy either.
No one's forced me to read Hegel, so I'm not a real philosopher.
Yeah, yeah. Have you been accused of, not accused, that's a strong word, but we'll use it. Have you been accused of letting your kind of your Christian background and your Christian beliefs kind of undermine your objectivity? In other words, between the data and the theological interpretation, you're always swayed towards the theological because of your background.
Yeah. Well, there's two things there. It's very much helped, and it sort of happened via a sort of happy accident, if you want to call it that way, that when I wrote the book, it was with Geraint, who was, first of all, he was my honours and master's supervisor, and then he was my colleague when I went back to Sydney, and he's professor of astrophysics at Sydney University. He's more senior than I am, and he's also an atheist.
Okay.
Right, so this idea of this is all just religious nonsense, or I, the senior part of this deal, just sort of blackmailed some atheist to agree with me about it. Like, that story doesn't fly.
Right.
So you can read in the book, as I said, we might be wrong, but we at least agree on what the science is. So a Christian and an atheist can agree this much about, the science. And that, I find that enormously helpful when I'm talking to especially a crowd of, say, skeptics, like the skeptics in the pub. that it just immediately dissolves a layer of objections, a pretty lazy layer of objections of, oh, you just, this is just apologetic. You just say this because blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And we can get onto the real questions, the real objections, the real sort of story there. But, you know, I think then it does depend a lot on the upbringing because Geraint wasn't raised as any sort of believer. And so I think the idea of God he has in his head is sort of, you know, floaty man on the clouds with a beard. Whereas I, having been raised in that, you know, I've read a lot more sort of theology. Whatever sort of idea I had when I was in Sunday school, I then sort of grew up and kept reading the Bible and read, you know, Aquinas and Augustine and a bunch of philosophers on this. So, yeah.
Right. How do you, you know, I was a former educator, former teacher back in the States, and I used to teach biology. And when we went through, you know, the origins and evolution and stuff, it was undoubtedly, I'm sure that I was very biased towards kind of a creation account. I didn't teach creationism. Obviously, I was in a public high school, but I at least taught the core problems with the theory of evolution. My question to you is, do you think that your students under you get a large dose of leaning towards theism in explaining all the cosmos?
I don't think so. I mean, they know about the book, but the sort of research I do scientifically, some of it isn't about fine-tuning at all. I mean, I want to know how galaxies form, so I've got students sort of working on that and observational projects and, you know, but I've got one student who's working with me and Geraint trying to do some simulations of what the universe might be like if this number was a bit different. So there's a bit of that as well. But he's actually a Muslim. He turned up from Pakistan, very keen to go, so there's no... Certainly he was there in the first place. So, no, I mean, one of the major things is I teach a first-year subject on, it's called scientific literacy, both being able to speak and talk coherently about science and knowing what science is. And I try to give, and the whole point of this lecture is I do a lecture on the sort of the Galileo incident, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. And I it's a real sort of myth-busting exercise of...
Yeah.
Like the reality is way more interesting and significantly different from the sort of common myth of scientists discover something about the world, church hates it, tries to
the
bury
memes
scientists.
And caricatures are very wrong. Yeah.
It's way more interesting than that. So for example, 1623, Galileo writes a book in honor of one of the cardinals, right? Barberini. Barberini writes a poem in honor of Galileo. Those two are friends, you know, right? They're best buds. And then Barberini becomes the Pope, right? That's the Pope who sent the Inquisition after Galileo 9 years later. Now, a lot happens in those 9 years.
Sure.
But it's his mate. It's his friend, right? That's a little detail you didn't, you know, that's not,
right.
Not, you know, discussed enough.
Yeah, well, it didn't help that he called him, was it Simplicio or Simplicito?
Simplicio, yeah.
Simplicio, the well, simpleton.
I think Galileo thought he'd get away with it because there was a philosopher in ancient Greece called Simplicio, but clearly in modern Italian, it sounded like a simpleton.
Simpleton, yeah.
And it's not that he directly calls the Pope that. The Pope had published something about the sort of controversy. And Galileo puts that argument in Simplicio's mouth in his book where there's this sort of discussion between these characters. One of them is Simplicio, who always turns out to be wrong. Yeah, so... But the thing is, here's the thing. Barberini, who became Pope Urban the 8th, I think it is, 7th, 8th, he's not a nice... He's a nutcase, right? So at one point, he's fighting... Because as all this is happening, right, we're in the aftermath of the... Protestant Revolution, right, Reformation. So half of Europe is turning its back on his church. And politically, he's not just a church leader. Like, there's no separation of church and state. He's a political leader as well. He's simultaneously, like, fighting wars on various parts. Europe is splitting. And this suddenly his mate, he's in an astronomy book, is slagging him off in print. At one point, and I think it's not long after Galileo, he is trying to sleep. There's so much happening. He can't sleep. And the birds are chirping in the papal gardens, in the Vatican gardens, just outside his window. And he wakes up in the morning and says, kill all the birds in the gardens.
Wow. That's right? funny.
That's a nutcase, right?
Yeah,
that's,
he's having a nervous breakdown or right. something.
And so here comes this, you know, and Galileo's not the most tactful character either. He's sort of a shoot his mouth off kind of guy who always wanted to be famous and he's loving every bit of his fame. It's sort of no PR, you know, no press is bad press. And then those two collide. And what else was going to happen?
It's
a crazy episode.
Yeah, it sounds like you've picked up a bit of church history in your studies as well.
Oh, it's fascinating. Yeah. Well, it's true. It's such a iconic bit of science history as well, right? Because the story of Galileo's this scientific hero, right, comes out immediately. It's not like centuries later we look back and go, like, because Europe is split, the Protestant half immediately sees that the Catholic Church has shot itself in the foot here, right? They've not handled this well. They've made one of their best and brightest and smartest, you know, and they've, you know, basically oppressed him and tried to shut him down. And so he in Germany, in England, like Galileo is immediately just a hero of science.
Yeah.
That comes not from like anti-Christians, but it comes from the Protestants who are just like, look at this. This is what happens when you put a pope in charge. We told you this was going to happen.
Was Galileo really imprisoned or house arrest? Because you hear those as well.
Yeah, so there's a wonderful book called Galileo Goes to Jail and Other Myths About Science, and the editor is Ronald Numbers. It's all these sort of short essays on these myths about science. Wonderful book, well worth a read. You know, it's a complete myth. So every time he visits Rome, he's traveling with the support of his hometown of Florence. Remember, these are sort of, they're not really just different cities in the same big old nation. They're almost like little nation states. So he travels to Rome, but he knows cardinals. So he's always staying in a cardinal's house, which would have been lovely and palatial and fantastic. So even before his trial, he's staying with one of his mates as a cardinal. And after his trial, he's sentenced to house arrest, but visits one of his mates and stays in his lovely house before he heads back to Florence. Now, I've actually been to the house he stayed in Florence. Ooh. And, you know, house arrest. It's a beautiful
bit of a misnomer.
It's like we have his letters at the time, and one of his main complaints about where he's staying is that the vineyard out the back of his house, the grapes from it make wine that's a little bit watery for his taste.
Oh, okay.
But that's the house. It's a beautiful house. It's now a museum to Galileo. But he's still writing books. At this point, he's 69 years old. He goes blind shortly after, just, you know, old age. But yeah, so, you know, it's funny because as he goes to Rome the first time, sort of around 1616, I think I've got the timescale right here, Rome wants to make a bit of an example of him, but he's under the protection of Florence and they won't let him. So he's, you know, Florence looks after him because he's their guy, right? So it's not like just the Protestants are against, like there's within the sort of the cities right next to each other in Italy, there's still all this politics going.
Do you have anything that's going on in your brain cosmologically or even theologically that's pushing you towards maybe another work, another book or something? Something's hot on your topic.
I am. I'm working on a book with tentatively the title How Christians Should Speak About Science, just because I think there's some various ways that we are sort of shooting ourselves in the foot. But more than that, I think there's a way that we could put some of those issues on the back burner and present a bit more of a united front. It's the positive ways to talk about, it's really how to talk about creation in a way where more scientific knowledge is just going to help. It's just going to help us out. So if if you're thankful for the way the world provides for you, learning more science is going to make you more thankful. You'll see how everything's connected behind the scenes, right? How it's, you know, this provision of, you just pick an apple off a tree. And now look at the biology of the tree and all of, and the water cycle and the nutrient cycle and all that sort of stuff. Add in the scientific information and you'll be more thankful. If that's the way we can just speak out loud about creation, not wait for the topic to come up, so that I can say, well, actually, God and science is, right? As someone who this is on the top of my mind for basically my whole life, waiting for it to come up in conversation is not good enough. It won't, right? It's very rare it actually just pops up.
Yeah, that's fair.
So active ways of just letting the way we see the world just infuse our, just our conversations, just the way you say, just say thank you when you see a beautiful day. Just say it out loud. So it's those sorts of ideas I'm sort of playing with at the moment.
So there might be a book in the works.
Well, most of it's written. I've just got to try and work out.
Oh, okay.
If it's, yeah. Anyway, we'll see.
Oh, cool. And do you, you know, I in reading a little bit about you online, it talked about theology. I kept hearing theology. And did you do preaching at churches or, you know, is it strictly on cosmology and whatnot? Or do you get into theological things, messages, that kind of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a sort of a lay preacher at my church. I'm in an Anglican church here in Sydney.
Okay.
But that's usually just, you know, the pastor's away and whatever's on the roster, up I go. So it's not usually aimed at my expertise, but I get invited to speak at churches in all over the place. Yeah. So I'm very happy to do that, whether it's a sort of
theological topics or cosmological topics.
Yes. Well, God and science. That's precisely the intersection. And a lot of that is a mate of mine explained this to me. He had me come and talk to his youth group in Sydney. And I said, oh, you know, you'll just introduce me and I'll get going. And he goes, no, we've got to interview you. It's important that you're to the kids. You're a real person. And I sort of realized the reason for that is that the main thing I bring is not the sort of talk I give. It's you sort of put me on stage and I could just have a shirt that just says, I'm a Christian and an astrophysicist. And that would be about 70% of the work done. Maybe 80%.
Probably.
Right? Just, I've just got to exist on stage, right? This is why the interview, like, look, here's a Christian who's a scientist. He's a real flesh and blood person. I could just wave for 5 minutes. Hi, everybody. Hi. Hey, how are you doing? And that would be a lot of what they remember. Like, other than talk about some stuff, but that, you know, you know, that sort of thing exists. There you go.
But do you think your book will appeal or be written that an atheist scientist, the type that would say, oh, you know, science and Christianity or religion don't have, you know, the non-overlapping magisterium or whatever. In other words, could an atheist read it and get anything out of it? And then, hey, you know, I need to rethink.
They could, but I'm aiming it specifically at Christians because I'm really taken by this, just thinking in my life about how many times it's just popped up in conversation. Like, if we could just grab every atheist and just drag them into the nearest Christian bookstore and push them into the right bin and hand them a, you know, John Lennox book or something. I think that work of, you know, can you be a scientist and a Christian? Here's scientists who are Christians. Here's arguments against naturalism. Here's why the two. I think a lot of that work's been done pretty well. I think, you know, my book's part of that. Fine tuning's part of that. But like on the broader scale, what the thing we need to do, but this assumption, if you believe in God, you can't believe in science. If you believe in science, you can't believe in God. It's still just, it's just out there like an ether. It's just sort of
too prevalent.
In the air. So we need a way of addressing it without waiting for it to come up in conversation, without the atheist coming up to us and going, hey, have you got a book about this or that or the other? It's like, okay, that's such a small, right? If every atheist was lovely and open-minded like that, it'd be great. But that's too small a market. We need, and I don't just want, I'm not looking for more scientists. Well, I'd love more Christians to become scientists, but just the average everyday person in how you talk about creation.
Yeah.
Talk about it in a way where it's obvious that more scientific knowledge will make you more thankful, more of a believer, more in admiration, more praise, right? These two will push in the same direction.
That's fair. You mentioned John Lennox. If I was anybody I could interview or meet and have a cup of coffee, it'd probably be him. Half of it being his accent. And have you met him?
I've met him. Yeah.
Tremendous guy.
He's great.
If you could sit down with any scientist, you know, past or present, have a coffee or whatever, who would it be?
Really good. Look, let me give you like a top five and then
okay.
I'll look.
Okay.
So this is the way you write down certain names. Einstein's an obvious one. Newton's an obvious one. Tell you what, most people wouldn't even put him in this category, but Aristotle is an obvious one, although the conversation would wander out of science, but I'd at least try and get him up to
philosophy.
Date. Yeah. Who else? I mean, Marie Curie won 2 Nobel Prizes in chemistry and physics. Mm. That's, That's interesting. Although, you got to get her at the right time in her life, because after a point, she's mildly radioactive.
Right, so, yeah, she got cancer from her rays she discovered, right?
Yeah, but lived a remarkably long time despite that fact. So her books, for example, the notebook she's done, they're behind, like, plated glass. They're still radioactive.
That's funny, sadly.
Who else? I think James Clerk Maxwell might be the last one. So Einstein, there's people, for a lot of them, it's, let me give you an update on where physics has got to, and now what do you think about all of this? And Einstein never believed in black holes and never really believed in gravitational waves either, I don't think. He thought that these were, they were solutions to his theory of gravity, of the way the universe might be, but they're just so particular. They're like, they're novelties. They wouldn't really happen in the world.
He didn't believe in spooky action at a distance either, did he?
Well, that's the other one. Bell's inequality. I'm talking to him about that. This is why Einstein's probably the top of that list.
Okay. Set him straight, huh?
I think he turned out to be right about a lot of stuff. This is what, the story about quantum mechanics is Einstein never liked it, and he was totally wrong about all it, ball one, the debate. I think he was right about a lot of stuff. That's a longer, much longer conversation. But I think he was, the way that he, he said there's got to be something happening behind the scenes here that makes all of these results of quantum mechanics true. Or, that you do the observations and they are. And Niels Bohr, the other great sort of pioneer of quantum mechanics, it's interesting how the philosophy is there behind the scene. But he was saying more, that there is no reality until we observe it. There's no fact about, what this electron as it moves through your apparatus, what it's really doing. There is no fact until it hits the screen at the end. So you don't say, which way did it go? Which way was it spinning? What's it doing here? There's no fact about any of that stuff. And Einstein said, that's bonkers. There's got to be
counterintuitive.
There's got to be something going on here. We need to tell a deeper story. And Einstein, I think, has turned out to be right. I mean, the history of quantum mechanics has turned away from Bohr, not entirely to Einstein. He was wrong about some very important things, but he's we've got to tell a story that fits the whole picture and is sort of back in some sense.
So you've got your list there. I think we'll start landing the plane here. Yeah, I was going to ask you if there's any questions or topics you wished I would have asked in this interview, but with 5 minutes, I don't know. What topics are you really passionate about that we might have missed?
We've roamed from Galileo to counterfactuals. This has been great. Yeah. And nothing in particular. This is
good. Well, let me ask you then something that I ask all my guests on here. And as a Christian, what waters your soul most as a Christian? In other words, people say, well, my walk with God has gone stagnant or whatever. And what things you do that kind of bring back a passion for Christ?
I heard a really good talk recently that sort of drilled some things home to me that I should have realized earlier. And now I really want to get his name. I think I know it. That's not it. I bought his book. Hang on, I'll find it. I just want to give him credit because it's really good.
Sure.
So the speaker was at something called Basecamp here in Sydney, was Zach Irwine, and did a wonderful set of talks about wisdom. He's got a book about that out, which I've bought but not read yet. And the point he was making was, okay, all of this stuff about wisdom is all great when it's sort of in the head, but how do we apply it to our lives? How is it going to sort of come home to us every day? And he almost had to sort of apologize for the answer to the question because it seems too obvious. But, it's going to be the love of God that does it. So how are we going to sort of apply it to our lives? And he thought, you've just got to bathe yourself in its presence for as long as you can and set aside a part of each day. Not, prayer, Bible study, of course, but get a Spotify playlist of all your favorite worship songs and just let it wash over you. Just dunk yourself in it day after day after day. Whatever songs just hit you right there, and just really properly marinate in it so it really soaks in, because we know it in our heads, but just letting it sort of get out into your bones to the ends of your fingers every day, I think that's some really, really good advice that I've been trying to take recently. So,
And it's bringing vitality back to your walk. Well, not that it was gone, but kicking it up a level.
You know, as a scientist, you sometimes think that sort of emotion is sort of a second-rate rational, you know, second-rate part of your brain that's just irrational and just reacts to stuff. And I think the fact that the Bible puts such an emphasis on music, you know, the longest book in the Bible is 150 songs.
Yeah.
Right, that's clearly something that's aimed at, like, the lyrics go here and the music hits right there, and it hits them both at the same time again and again until you
that's fair
feel it. So I don't think that's any sort of coincidence. If music is one of the ways we learn, then clearly God wanted to hit the head and the heart at the same time.
Yeah, cool. Well, listen, we've gone our hour, so I better start to sign off. Luke, thanks so much for joining in, and you know, you bring your unique insights and kind of helping us understand the mysteries of the universe just a little bit more, because to even though I taught astronomy for 5 years, it's still a bit mysterious out there. And people like you, you're expanding the borders of knowledge. So we appreciate that. So for our listeners, if you want to, you know, dig a little bit deeper into his work, buy his book, A Fortunate Universe, or The Cosmic Revolutionary's Handbook. And, you know, I hope to see you on more Thinking Matters podcasts. Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you next time. God bless.
Thank you.
For more reasons why we believe,
or to support this ministry, go to
thinkingmatters.org.nz.